Welcome to the 10th anniversary edition of Reservoir Dogs. On this commentary track, you will hear writer and director Quentin Tarantino, producer Lawrence Bender, executive producer Monty Hellman, director of photography Andre Sekula, editor Sally Mankey, and actors Tim Roth, Chris Penn, Michael Madsen, and Kirk Voltz. Producer Lawrence Bender.
What's funny, my ex-girlfriend from years ago, I think still thinks it's my best movie, and she said it was like a Greek tragedy. But maybe it's more of a guy movie. Maybe guys tend to go for it more than gals. In the past, people say, well, why don't you do a director's cut and we could re-release the movie? And there's no reason to do that. This has always been our favorite cut. Quentin, he had it in his head, I don't know, for years, and he just literally just regurgitated it out. And it was pretty funny because it was all those bad spelling and doesn't look like a script because it's not formatted, quote unquote, the way a script is supposed to be formatted. But I read it right there and I felt this energy. I felt this, wow, we're in for something really wonderful. Quentin does have a very specific style and he's very specific with the camera when he shoots. Even though he was directing on the page and now putting on the director hat and going through the script as director and doing shot listing the entire script. And then Monty and I would sit down with Quentin and go through, you know, scene by scene how he's going to shoot it and what we thought we could fit in a day. And we really went through that whole process. But what was great, though, is we went through looking for locations and things. There were some very specific things we were looking for to sort of help find his vision. I mean, this cat is like Charles
Bronson in The Great Escape. We caught up with executive producer Monty Hellman at his home.
I was really intrigued with the way he shot the coffee house scene. I'd never seen anything done quite like that, where he just kept the camera moving, and he would shoot a number of takes, and it would never be the same. And I just had no idea how that was going to cut together, and it did, you know. But it was like a kind of really, I think that's one of the most revolutionary techniques in the movie.
Director of photography, Andre Sekula.
First of all, when we discussed the script, it was a long dialogue scene. It was like 12 or 14 pages. And credit sequence. So it could be a big nightmare to shoot this in a way to respect axis of camera, line, eye line, all these things. So I said, let's say shot this and solve all this problem in post-production. And cameras should move all the time. So we designed this that we put a track around the table and shot with different lenses and concentrate on certain characters. And later he and editor solved in post-production. And also we going to cover static, so they could use either tracking or static. We repeat many, many times the same dialogue, and camera was moving half circle. And later when we reach the end, camera move back. The same technique very often you use in music videos, you see. They put in camera moving around and they're just trying to catch certain element and later they edit it.
When it was big, I must have heard it a million trillion fucking times.
And Quentin, I didn't want to be kind of like breathing down his neck. I didn't want him to feel that I was like watching his every move. And I wasn't. That was never my intention. But I just felt comfortable coming every other day, every third day. I was instrumental in finding Andre. Another friend of mine gave me a reel of his commercials, and I was really impressed. I thought he was terrific.
You guys can get the tip.
Tarantino was completely open for this, and I had to tell you, this was his strength, because he was open, he was considering everything, we were discussing all this, you know, like perfect collaboration. Normal work like with any other director, you know, with different vision. You see, always when he looks at this, yeah, he's good, and he's accepting this. Very easy, or at least at that time. His judgment is good.
Come on, throw in a buck.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
We shoot this 2 or 3 days. It was the first day of shooting. So everybody was kind of a little bit insecure. So when we first time we went to see Rushes, everybody was kind of quiet. I did feel a little bit, oh God, everybody looking what we going to have, because suddenly we start breaking rules. We just dump all these axes of lines and what we're going to have. And of course, particularly with first-time director Quentin Tarantino, you know, we did not know what we have. Only person who knows, I did know, because I did operate camera, and I could really judge all these images, and I know that we have good stuff. So we went to photo camp to see the rushes, and after 2 minutes, everybody was so happy. Suddenly, out of nowhere, just popping up cans of beer, everybody drinking, jumping, congratulating. And this moment was kind of breaking all the ice between producers, crew, and me. Now it was time of delivery, and delivery was good. In principle, very often they give job to first-time director, but never to first-time DP, who going to shoot first-time director's movie. So I had to give big prize for Quentin and production, Lawrence Bender and Monty Hellman and Richard Gladstein to really trust.
In this country, it's the one job basically any woman can get and make a living on. The reason is because of their tips.
Fuck all that.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I'm very sorry the government taxes their tips. That's fucked up. That ain't my fault. I mean, it would appear that waitresses are one of the many...
Sally Menke, editor.
I had read the script, and boy, I was just so crazy about it. I met Quentin, and I adored him from the get-go. He was just so happy to be alive. My agent tried to convince me not to do the film, and I said, no, I'm going to do the film. You know, a lot of times the script's not so good, but the director is enthusiastic, and so you take a project because of that, or vice versa. And with QT, it was both. It was like, oh my God, the script's great, and he's incredible, and this is incredible, and the actors are incredible. Everything was perfect. So it was very exciting. And we just liked each other. It was odd. And, you know, I made some goofy mistake when the interview. I think I, like, almost fell off the chair, which I usually do. And, you know, I always do something really dumb. I think one of the first days we were editing, I rolled his finger up in the automatic window. You know, it was pretty embarrassing. But we just got on. And we just became partners in that way.
That was the Partridge Family's Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted, followed by Edison Lighthouse's Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, as K. Billy's super sounds of the 70s weekend just keeps on trucking.
To make it different, we shoot this whole segment in 12 frames per second and later speed up to double the frames. It was step printing to get to return to normal movement. So when you see it's kind of strange move, it's like floating but natural.
Caught up with producer Richard Gladstein in his office.
In terms of the music, the majority of it Quentin had in his head when he was writing the script and knew the songs he was going to use. Probably not all of them, but a significant amount of them. So the interesting thing is that in neither Pulp Fiction or in Reservoir Dogs is there any score. It's only songs, and it's only pre-recorded songs. He's not even recording original songs for the film. Everything is sort of bought, if you will, and that's just placed in according to the way he wants to do it. The other interesting thing about the soundtrack to Reservoir Dogs, which I think helped propel it to selling so well, is that it was Quentin's idea to just put dialogue from the film in the CD, which at that time I don't think was really done. I remember when he said he wanted to do it, I thought it was the wackiest idea, but great. And the way he used it and where he chose it and how he laid it in, I thought was great. So it makes listening to the record that much more of a reminder of the film, because I mean, he knew that people were going to turn on the radio and hear this.
Just hold on, buddy boy.
I'm going to die.
Hey.
I'm sorry.
When Tim Roth and Harvey Keitel is sitting in car and camera moving in both directions, I was opposing to shoot this way. And Quentin said, oh, Andre, please do this way. I said, okay, we're going to do. I don't mind to do this. It's because only film. But let's cover also this scene with static shot. The reason I was saying this because I try to avoid presence of camera as much as possible. If someone said, oh, what a beautiful camera movement, it means I fail. It could be movement, but when people concentrate on action, and I said, Quentin, by this movement, we reveal presence of camera, period. There's no way. We're outside the car and camera move. And we make a couple of takes, and suddenly it works. I was moving camera, and I don't know what it was. It was kind of intuition, or God told me in which moment to pan left or right. It just worked very well. And one don't feel presence of camera. Also, the stuff we cover later, he used in the later part. So it's not all the time, you know, camera is moving.
Okay.
Now you have the scene was handheld, and when you open the door, you see one of the generator on the left side of the door. But it was, at the beginning, it was a big issue. Lawrence Bender mentioned, oh, why are we seeing this? I said, well, you know, this is a truck. We see barely wheels and a little bit of the car. Nobody will look at this. You know that this generator, I know, but, you know, nobody will question. If someone questions, it means something is wrong with the movie.
Kirk Baltz.
It was the hottest script in town by far. Everybody wanted to do it. Everybody was saying, did you go in on Reservoir Dogs? Did you read it? What do you think? I had never read a storyline that had so many ins and outs and had so many different places to go. And just the opportunity to work with a bunch of guys like this. I was pretty new to acting. Harvey was always, I was always a huge fan of his. I remember the movies of Tim's that he had coming out. I did a short film with Steve Buscemi in New York that Robert Longo directed, so I knew Steve. And having just seen Michael and Thelma and Louise, you know, and Chris and Rumblefish, I mean, it was endless. There were all these guys all of a sudden that every movie that any of them had done, I liked, and their work blew me away. And I was like, wow. Then we began rehearsing and began working on it. I think we had about a week or 2 weeks of rehearsal and table readings. And Quentin was always really clear and really specific about what he wanted. He always knew exactly where his camera was going to go. If there were questions about lines of dialogue or anything, and you went to Quentin with him, he had the answer, and he was very clear about why that was there and what he wanted. You know, you follow somebody who's that clear and is that focused and has that strong of a vision. It's easy for you to go along with them.
Monty Hellman.
I got a call from a friend, Lori, who said she had a terrific script. And she started to read it to me over the phone. And I just, you know, I flipped. I said, that, you know, it's very hard for me to get to read a script. I get scripts all the time, and I've had great scripts that I've decided I wanted to do that I've had sitting in my office for 6 months. And this one, I said, I've got to read it right away. And so she brought it over, and I read the script. And she set up a meeting with me and Lawrence first. And the idea was that I would direct it. And then they set up a meeting with Quentin. And at that time, he was living with his mother in Pasadena or someplace. He met me at C.C. Brown's, which was famous, was there for years. It's gone now, but it was like one of the places everybody went after going to the movies on Hollywood Boulevard. And we had Hot Fudge Sundays, which it was famous for. Quentin said, you know, I hate to waste your time, he said, but something's happened today that has changed everything for me. He's I sold a script, and now I want to direct Reservoir Dogs. I'm not that I didn't want to before, but I'm going to hold out to direct it. And over the course of our Hot Fudge Sundays, he said, well, maybe, you know, maybe there'd be some way that you know, you might be able to help. And I said, well, if I can help get it set up or whatever, I would be really happy to be involved. I said, I've never, you know, seen anything you've done. I don't know if you've done anything, but I believe in you. And everybody else did, too. I mean, that was the great thing about Quentin. He could really you know, convince you that he had this great talent, which he did. You know, it wasn't that he was, you know, deceiving anybody, but I was immediately convinced, and so I set out to try to help set it up, and we had actually several deals that I initiated that he turned down because he didn't like the way the company saw the film in terms of how they were going to cast it and what kind of picture they wanted to make and so forth. And I gave it to Richard Gladstein because I had done Silent Night, Deadly Night for Live Entertainment, which became Artisan. Richard read it immediately. I took it to his apartment. The next day he said, I want to do it. And we brought Quentin in, and the rest is history, as they say.
Lawrence Bender.
It's funny, because I was a struggling producer and he was a struggling director. It never occurred to me, could Quentin do this? People started asking, well, why do you think you can direct this? Like, you know, and tell me how you see it. And it just never occurred to me that he couldn't do it. It's an odd thing. Maybe it's just, you know, because I'd never done it before, so it never occurred to me that somebody couldn't do it. And I just got lucky, you know, because we found each other. And then he said to me, actually, if I direct this movie half as good as I wrote it, we're going to have a decent movie. We'll probably get to do another movie together. I mean, that was kind of our thing. If we could just create like a decent version of the script, we'll get another movie. But quite frankly, just the way he would talk about it visually and referencing different visual aspects of different movies, and I just felt like he saw it. He just saw it from the beginning, and it was never an issue. We'd walk in. The other interesting thing was, as we were walking into other financers, like we went into somebody, and he said, I'll give you $1.6 million. Here's the only problem. Or not problem. Here's the only change. At the end, it needs to be like The Sting, where everyone actually is not dead, and they get up. Now, you got to, you know, for someone who's, like, struggling, and, you know, you really want to make your first movie, and someone's going to give you $1,600,000, but, you know, we go, that just doesn't work. But we always had the confidence. We were walking in on equal footing, because we always knew we had Quentin's $50,000 that he was just about to get from the option from True Romance. So we had this one financer who was giving us $500,000, if his girlfriend could play Mr. Blonde. You know, I mean, there's some pretty bizarre things that came up along the way. And now we actually went back and for about a half hour, we talked about, could that work? And we go, no, it couldn't work. We thought about it for a second there because, you know, you're like, you're working it, boy. You're trying to figure out, you know, you want to make your movie. And it's not, it's easy to say now, but you know, you're begging and borrowing.
Need you cool. Are you cool? Some water in this.
That casting process was probably the best casting process I'll ever go through because it was really like casting a Broadway show. And then we could have cast then our road show and our national tour and our local theater show, and we could have cast our, you know, overseas show. And there's so many great actors actually that came in. And it was really about putting together the right ensemble, the right group, the right chemistry between each one. And we could have done it in so many different ways. There was definitely a point in time where Quentin was thinking about playing Mr. Pink. I think when Quentin writes a script, he plays every part. Every movie, whether it's a male or a you know, female, black or white, he's playing every part as he's writing it. He is that character, so in a sense, he gets to do all that. So Quentin's a multiple personality when he's writing.
Quentin Tarantino.
I had written Mr. Pink for myself because I didn't know we were going to be doing it in a, like a real movie. You know? I thought we were going to be doing 16mm. And Harvey Keitel was into me playing the role. And so what happened was Steve tells the story, and it's true. All right, you know, I really kind of thought Steve could do it. He could be really good. And I had all these actors read for Mr. Pink and everything. And the whole thing was going to be this. We were going to do audition, all these actors, and on the last day of auditions, I was going to read for Mr. Pink, for Harvey and Lawrence and Richard Gladstein and the casting director, and we were going to make the decision then. What happened was, Steve came in, and this is a, and he didn't do a great audition. He did a good audition. Steve didn't kill in the room, but I was really familiar with his work. I'd seen Parting Glances and a couple other things, and I knew what a terrific actor he was. And I had got everybody else in the ensemble, and he just fit in perfect. So he didn't need to kill in the room. I knew he was good. I knew he was terrific, and I knew he would fit in the ensemble great. And he just gives a fantastic performance. But before he came in, some people you could say this is like a bad thing to say before an audition, but it wasn't. I was laying down the fucking line for him. I go and see him before he goes in the waiting room, and I talk to him and go, look, I want you to understand something. I wrote the part of Mr. Pink for myself. So I ain't giving you shit. You're gonna have to take it. You gotta go in there and you gotta take it. Otherwise you ain't gonna get it. I hope I didn't fuck you up. But I ain't giving you jack shit. You gotta take it from me. So go in there and do it. Now he didn't, actually. He only did a good job. Maybe I did fuck him up. All right, you know, but if that fucks him up.
Tim Roth.
A lot of first-time directors, I mean, some, the bad ones are ones who are just auditioning for Hollywood as opposed to making a film for themselves. And I'm not really that interested in them. But I think it's even. I think some filmmakers like Altman, you know, certainly in the old days used to take risks, you know, and some first-time directors do and don't. I really think it's even across the board. And with regards to talent, too. Having made a lot of films doesn't necessarily make you a good filmmaker.
Kill anybody? A few cops. No real people?
Just cops.
With Reservoir Dogs, we cut the film on film. And then after Reservoir Dogs, I started working on The Avid. Actually, it was the Lightworks. And never want to go back. Although I have had a couple of directors, Quentin included, who have threatened to go back to film. But I really enjoy, I mean, I like touching film, although it's, you know, really dirty. The Avid to me, you know, computer editing, it just offers you the flexibility to really study a performance quickly. And I don't mean quickly so that you don't get the best that you can. I just mean, you know, you have such fluidity that you can go between different performances so much faster than film, where, you know, the core always falls out of the roll of film, and then you have to wind it on a bench, and it takes so long, and trims are lost, and you can't find the trim, so you can't watch the take, or there's white meter in the middle, and, you know, on and on and on. It's just a mess. And in digital, the digital world, it's not like that. Sometimes producers go, well, you know, it's digital, you can do it faster. But you still need the same exact amount of time to enhance a performance or to study a performance or build a character. There, you know, to think about the character takes the same amount of time. So I really like the digital world for performance.
Me and Orange jumped in the car, ground floored it. After that, I don't know what went down.
Oh, at that point, it was every man for himself, man. As far as Mr. Blonde and Mr. Blue are concerned, I ain't got the foggiest, because once I got out, I never looked back.
What do you think?
What do I think? I mean, you know, the cops either caught him or killed him.
Got a chance to punch through, you found a hole.
Yeah, and that was a fucking miracle. But even if they did get away, then where the fuck are they?
You don't think it's possible one of them got a hold of diamonds and...
No way.
I was cutting documentaries for about 8 to 10 years before I moved to LA and got into features. And I was crossing over in New York, so I was kind of doing low budget. I had done a low budget feature, and then I had done some small dramatic shorts and things like that. And it's the best training to be in documentaries. You just have to be able to structure a story or a sentence or a paragraph or a moment from gobs and gobs and gobs and gobs of footage. And you have to be agile with it. You have to be able to take it to unscripted areas and have it make sense. I think that perhaps that was a little, not knowing it, but was training for, you know, being able to feel very comfortable with working with someone who wants to fracture time a little bit.
It was a four-man job. I discovered one of the team was an undercover cop.
Oh, shit.
Thank God we discovered it.
It's not like I think movies should be that way, but it's like they can be that way. They shouldn't be any one way. They should be just what's ever the most interesting for them. It's like most novels you read, say 65% of them, are told in a linear fashion. But they don't have to be, all right? And you don't think anything about it, all right? And you know, in a novel, all of a sudden it starts in the middle of the story, in chapter 1 and 2 and 3, and all of a sudden chapter 4 comes on, and it takes place like 30 years earlier, or 2 years earlier, or 6 months earlier. You go with it. And it's not a flashback. No, it's just the order of the information that the author has decided to tell you the story in. It's completely up to the author. I get pissed off when people call my stuff flashbacks. I'll let you know when it's a fucking flashback, all right? Literally, what a flashback is, it is a character thinking back on something. It's not me telling the audience in a different order. It's a personal thing of a character thinking back. That's not the situation. I try to duplicate a novel kind of thing. Kind of keep going back from time to time. You know, all those like the Mr. Orange and the Mr. White, the Mr. Blonde chapters, those are separate chapters. The way I used to describe it a long time ago is like, okay, you're reading a novel and, you know, Mo, Larry, and Curly are doing something, all right? And they're like going on this forward momentum, I mean, this through line going on. Okay, chapter 1, Mo, Larry, and Curly are doing this. And chapter 2, Mo, Larry, and Curly are a little further on their way. Chapter 3, Mo, Larry, and Curly are doing something more. All right, now comes chapter 4. And it's Mo.
You push that woman-man thing too long, and it gets to you after a while.
What's she doing now?
She hooked up with Frank McGar. They've done a couple of jobs together. Hell of a woman. Good little thief. So explain the telegram.
Five-man job. Busted in and busted out of a diamond wholesalers.
Can you move the ice afterwards? I don't know nobody that can move ice.
No problem. We got guys waiting for it. Hey, what happened to Marcellus Spivey? Didn't he always move your ice?
Nah, he's doing 20 years in Susanville.
20 years, holy God. What for?
Bad luck.
I guess you can say that again.
What's the exposure like?
2 minutes, tops. But it's a tough 2 minutes. Daylight, during business hours, dealing with the crowd. But you'll have the guys to deal with the crowd.
How many employees?
I'd say around 20. Security pretty lax. They most usually just deal in boxes.
Richard Gladstein.
One of the most unique things about Quentin is that he writes a script, shoots a film, and I don't think he's concerned at all about what the audience thinks of what he's doing or how the audience will respond. Quentin's basically making the movie for him, and maybe someone will watch it and maybe someone will like it, but he's looking to entertain himself and to tell a story that means something to him, and have the actors act and treat each other in a way that's true to the story he created, and hopefully that will appeal to someone else. But when Quentin's making the film, he's not hoping the audience will do this, or maybe it'll be imitated like this, or maybe this will become an Academy Award nominated screenplay, and Quentin doesn't think that way. He thinks, I want to tell a story, I want it to be true to the story, and if anyone else likes it, that would be great.
Without medical attention, the man might not live through the night. A bullet in his belly is my fault. Now, while that might not mean jack shit to you, it means a hell of a lot to me.
Well, first things first, okay? Staying here is goofy. We got to book up.
What do you suggest we do? Go to a hotel? We got a guy shot in the belly. Can't walk. He bleeds like a stuck pig.
Before us, in this location was used by other film crew. And they painted the window, which was kind of translucent, but, you know, it cut a lot of light. So I need to use a lot of light shining through the windows to allow light to go through the paint. So I have incredible amount of 12K HMI burning all the time.
He's got dead cops, dead robbers, dead civilians.
at that time when I did this movie, the fashion of most of the film was shot with soft light. Usually they're bouncing from the ceiling. I use here hard light. I never use any diffusion.
He was asking me to take him to it.
First of all, because of the nature of the film stock, it was 50 SA film stock. Second, to get this impression of expressionics in the impression, kind of contrast.
Well, all right, then I guess we take him to a hospital. I mean, if that's what he said, let's do it. Since you don't know nothing about us, I say it's his decision.
It was fantastic collaboration with David Wasko, production designer, because when I go on board, and I believe how many weeks of pre-production I did have. I believe 2 weeks. With him, these 2 weeks, we together sit on each location and discuss what we could do, what he could help me to find instrument, lights, all these things. Because from the beginning, we told it would be a lot of handheld, and it would be a lot of, you know, like 180 or 200 or 360 degree camera movement. So he came with devices which served me for hiding the lights.
I mean, the man was dying in my arms. What the fuck was I supposed to do? Tell him I'm sorry? I can't give out that fucking information. It's against the rules.
We shot this in, I believe, in August. August, September. And it was really hot in Los Angeles. So I get, you know, I get a little bit rap about this hot light, but, you know, I was guilty maybe a little bit, but most of this was really weather guilty weather, you know, because it was hot, and I added a little bit to this situation.
If I have to tell you again to back off, then you're going to go round and round.
And of course, when you have light, when you people become tired, become much more, you know, uncomfortable. But it's nature of the lens, nature of the stock, nature of the camera. And if you want to get maximum quality, you have to suffer a little bit. Maybe now technique change, and film stock become much better, lenses become better. You know, and now is no reason to use. But still, if you use this film stock, you get quality which no any other film stock could deliver.
Your buddy there is stuck in a situation you created. So if you want to throw bad looks away, throw him out of the mirror.
You kids shouldn't play so rough. Somebody's going to start crying.
Mr. Blunt. Kicking me.
Lawrence Bender.
And I remember watching how Quentin would shoot Reservoir Dogs, and there'd be times where you felt like you were almost in a play, because the you'd be all back at the end, you know, at the end of that warehouse, and you'd be these great long takes, and we'd all sit back and watch and just go, wow. And then you'd watch the dailies, and take after take, you'd go, oh, you don't want to cut into that. It's such a great scene, you know, and then you see another take, and you go, oh, you don't want to cut into that. And so you cut it together. Doing Reservoir Dogs, we were like doing everything for the first time. But somehow, we were so, whatever we had done to that point in each of our lives to get to that point, we had all that potential energy that was waiting to get transferred into kinetic energy. It was just ready to go. All my background came to play, all his background came to play, and we did everything we could to just make that a great movie. But, you know, that's what everybody does. Everybody sets out to make a great movie. But, you know, that was our first movie, so it's a very special movie. It's like having your first child or something like that, you know?
Fuck you, maniac! It's your fucking fault we're in this trouble!
What's this guy's problem?
What's my problem?
I met Michael once before, and he came in red, and he was just, like, fantastic. And I was, like, trying to decide. And it was one of those, Michael came in and gave such a great reading, but we were going to lose Michael to another movie, and we weren't quite ready yet to start making final decisions, but we kicked up all the Mr. Blondes that were good almost in order to either give Michael the part or at least get Michael out of the running. I mean, you know what I mean? So we can let Michael go and do this other movie, and then we can make up our minds later about Mr. Blonde. But Michael won it hands down. And by the way, for any actors out there that, like, trying to get a job kind of thing, and you don't know how to deal with the room, and you try to be a good boy and everything, not always being a good boy, it's being a good actor and going in there and doing what you want when you want to do it, right? To give you an example, for this big callback thing with actors for Mr. Blonde, first Michael came in, he was supposed to read, and he didn't read. He goes, well, you know, I just thought, you know, we'd talk for a little bit. You know, I'm like, okay, break the rules, that's okay. You're gonna read for me before it's all fucking over, all right? But this time we can just talk, okay? I didn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking. Okay, good for you, all right? But, you know, you're gonna read at the end of the day. Maybe not today, but at some point you will read. But at this point, yes, okay, we'll just talk, all right? And then, okay, I want you to do his chapter scene, you know, the scene where he's talking to Joe Cabot. So he comes back another day, and he does that scene. And then it's like, okay, for the big comeback scene, you know, callback scene, I mean to say, all right, I want you to do that scene again. And then I want to see the torture scene. I want you to do your version of the torture scene. And so now for the callback scenes, okay, we had everybody else come and do that scene with Joe Cabot and the torture scene. And one of the things I said, like, look, you can use Stuck in the Middle with You, but you don't have to. You can use any song that you feel comfortable with using that you'd like to do. You know, if you want to use Stuck in the Middle with You, use Stuck in the Middle with You. But I don't want to lock you down. You can use anything you want to show your best foot forward in my office. Only a couple of people picked a different song, all right? Almost everybody picked Stuck in the Middle with You. And, I mean, and they were like, you know, I tried to use other songs, but, you know, you fucking nailed it, man. Stuck in the Middle with You gets it. I don't know why it gets it, but it gets it, all right? And the first actor to do it, that came in to do it, to Stuck in the Middle with You, only gave an okay job, but I just knew that scene was gonna work great. That was the first time I'd actually seen the scene acted out with that music playing. Michael's the last guy after I've been seeing the torture scene done all day long. Michael comes in and goes, yeah, you know, I didn't do that torture scene. I just, like, you know, scene I did before. I just, you know, just gonna do that. Well, okay. Let's see it. He did such a good job with it. He, you know, it's like he did it once and he'd taken it to just such a different place. Not a different place, just better. It was just, it was good the first time, but it was just filled in. It's like, if you're gonna do that, you gotta back it up. Okay, fuck all that. I ain't doing any of that bells and whistles shit. I just got serious about the first scene you gave me and just really, really did it. And he got the part.
Get him the fuck out of here.
Hey, Sid, will you relax? I know you a long time. I'm not worried. I know you'll pay.
Monty Hellman.
It's one of the few scenes that was shot away from our main location, the main area in Eagle Rock. It was shot in an office building, I think, on Wilshire Boulevard. And it was limiting kind of location because really, they just had a lot of depth to the set, but not much width. So there wasn't a lot of room to move around. So he was limited in the way he could cover the scene, and I think it came out really well.
How does freedom feel, huh? It's a change. Ain't that the sad truth?
As a DP, when they ask me, where is my mark? I said, well, you, this area, this is your playground, but I prepare you light. And I give so-called tips that they could use or not to their advantage. Very often they don't do it. My character feel this. Well, okay, it feel this, but, you know, viewer doesn't see it. So take advantage of this, all this kind of light, camera movement, all this. And if someone know, they could use it very successfully. You know, this small element could change. Sometimes patch of light could do magic for actors. They move their face, look different. I need helping them in acting. Something like using slow stock, sharper stock, when I have close-up of actors, and actors' pupil change. So if it's clear, you could see it, and later it pay off, you know, on the way to pick up Oscars.
Well, tell me a story, kid. What are your plans?
Jeez.
of a bitch. I see you sitting there, but I don't believe it. How you doing, toothpick?
Hey, Eddie.
Listen, I'm sorry. I should have picked you up myself. It's been, this week's been crazy. I don't have my head on my ass the whole time.
Chris Penn.
That was the first day of shooting. It was me and Michael and Lawrence Tierney in his office. I didn't really want to get beat wrestling, so I went to Michael and I said, hey, how about we really wrestle? He was fine with me. He was supposed to beat me wrestling. So I wrestled in school and stuff. So I kind of knew what I was doing when I asked Michael. And God bless him for doing it. And God bless Quentin, because it made the scene fun for me. Because being that it was such a guerrilla, low-budget film, we were all so anxious to do it, there was a lot of that from everybody, where it was like, hey, man, I really want to do this, but let's let it all hang out. Let's get, you know, it's not necessarily stage this. I got to go down like this and have it all propped up. And it was kind of like, you know, we shot from the hip. Everybody shot from the hip.
All right, enough of this shit. Break it up. Come on, this ain't a playground.
So I went to Quentin and I said, how about we just really wrestle? Quentin goes, well, let's get, but to his credit, he goes, all right, let's see what it turns out to be. And of course, that's the way it turned out to be. It was only like two takes. They were exactly the same. And I was okay, we can move on. I wasn't out of breath, though. I was just breaking a sweat. I was having a good time.
Michael Madsen.
Well, what I remember about that scene is that Chris and I were really having a lot of fun that day, and we were fighting quite a bit, and we kept rehearsing that scene, and we were having a good time. And I think what happened was we had gone through it so many times by the time he shot the scene, we were both exhausted. If you look at the film and you look at us, we're both sweating and we're both breathing pretty heavy because we had been wrestling around for like 4 or 5 minutes before we shot the scene. Every time he tried to shoot it, we kept going out of frame. You know, I went over the desk one time and I know a couple times we went right head over, you know. Finally, when we shot it, you know, we were told, well, you got to stay right against the wall over here and right by the desk. And so we tried to contain it right in the little area that we were in. But we were both pretty ripped and we were both kind of like, oh, man, you know, like we were very tired and we were kind of burnt out. If you weren't looking for it, you can't really see it. But if you know that story and then you see it, you can see how we were huffing and puffing because we were pretty tired from fooling around so much.
Fuck. Harry's a motherfucker.
Oh, he's a fucker. Won't even let me leave the halfway house unless I get some shitty job.
Hey, you come back to work for us, man.
Well, I wanna. First, I gotta prove to asshead that I can get a regular, you know, job type job before I can move out on my own. I can't come back to work for you guys if I gotta worry about making some silly ass 10 o'clock curfew every fucking night.
Chris Penn and Lawrence Tierney are sort of like connected at the hip in this movie. You know, it was like, you know, Joe, the character Joe Cabot, was much harder to cast. And we had a lot of choices for a Nice Guy Eddie because it's such a very interesting character. But Nice Guy Eddie had to be married to Joe. I had to kind of cast Joe first. And then whoever I would cast as Joe would dictate who I cast as Nice Guy Eddie. You know, if someone's going to play father and son, I don't want them, you know, I want them to look alike. You know, I want them to have some sense of each other, you know. Because in real life, you know, fucking fathers and sons look like each other in real life. You know, it doesn't happen that much in the movies. But in real life, it fucking happens a lot. All right, brothers and sisters tend to look like each other, all right. Mothers tend to look like their daughters, all right. Go figure. And so, you know, I had a couple different pairings. But there's just something so choice about them playing father and son, just something so great. It's just so unique, so special, so just worth sending to the lab, you know. Any other direction, yeah, it just wouldn't be as fruitful.
Richard Gladstein.
The thing about Quentin is also he watches 8 million movies, and Quentin would be the first one to say, of course I borrowed that from that movie. Of course I did. I'm not trying to conceal that. I did it because I love it. So to not be inspired by another person means you're a fool. It means you're absolutely dead intellectually. To not be inspired and spurred on and motivated by what another filmmaker did, you'd have to live in a cave somewhere.
Look, just let Eddie for now set you up at law.
Monty Hellman.
As an audience, I react in a certain way to movies, and that is I create my own movie as I'm watching a movie, and so sometimes I can leave a movie and not be able to tell you what the story was about, because I've had an experience. I have a real kind of, like, I take a little dream, I take a little trip while watching a movie, and if it's a good movie, I can see it again and again, because I'll keep seeing different things in it. And so I want an audience to participate. I want them to have their own trip, and I don't care if it's the same as my trip. I just want them to have a good trip with it. And so I don't mind if there's little gaps, because I want them to fill in those gaps.
K-Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s continues. And if you're the 12th caller, you'll win two tickets to the Monster Truck Extravaganza being held tonight at the Carson Fairgrounds, featuring Big Daddy Don Bodine's truck, the Behemoth. The 12th caller wins on the station.
Now, it's a little different situation when you see Reservoir Dogs, especially after you've seen it once or twice and you know, got a good handle on it. But when people were seeing it for the very first time, I mean, it really cut their heads off. They had no idea what to expect. And I just couldn't believe that everyone found the movie so violent. All right, just such rough viewing experience. So when you see it a second time, then the humor plays more overtly. People laughed through the entire movie when they saw it the first time, but when it's over, they don't quite remember laughing. All right, second time, it's like, it seems much less violent and much more funny. All right, and I realized what that was at a certain point. And it was, because I was like, in the script, I was like, hey guys, I'm appreciating you thinking it's the most violent movie ever made. That you're just giving me kudos as a filmmaker. You're saying, hey guy, great filmmaking, because it's like a fucking talk fest. All right, you know, I was afraid it was gonna be boring. It wasn't because people were seeing violence on screen, or even violent stuff was happening constantly. It was the fact that the threat of violence is there every second as the movie's going on. It's like the threat of violence is another character in the room. It's a sword of Damocles, not only hanging over all the characters' head, it's hanging over the audience's head, and you're waiting for it to drop at any moment, and it could happen at any moment. At any moment, there could be blood all over the walls. And the best analogy I was able to put to it much later was, I'm also a big fan of melodramas, and I remember watching the movie Backstreet, big melodrama where you know it's just going to end awful for her and very sad and dramatic. And melodrama, just like violence from Reservoir Dogs, was always another character in the room. Anytime a light scene happened, you could only think it was so light, you only laugh so much because, like, the threat of melodrama was so hanging over this woman's head, all right, that any little reprise in it was just, it's just going to get worse really quickly. And so violence kind of had the same relationship. Even when things got light and funny, it could just turn like that in any moment. But it's like, I really think that also part of really what I have to offer in cinema, because I like things that can switch tones, is being able to turn on a dime. I mean, I love playing with an audience and conducting an audience's response, because it's like I love getting people to laugh at things that they would never laugh at. All right, and you know, can't even imagine they would laugh. You laugh, and then I stop you laughing. All right, and then I get you right where you fucking breathe. All right, and then I make you laugh again, right while you're still in that other thing. I get you laughing again.
Give me a fucking chance to breathe. I got a few questions of my own here.
You ain't dying, he is.
All right, Mr. Fucking Compassion, I will call somebody.
Who?
A fucking snake charmer. What do you think? I'll call a doctor. They'll fix him right up. Now, what happened to Brown and Blue?
Brown's dead. We don't know what happened to Blue.
Brown's dead? Are you sure?
I'm sure. I was there. Took one in the head.
Nobody's got a clue what happened to Mr. Blue?
Either he's alive or he's dead, or the cops got him, or they don't.
Take this, the bastard you told me about? Why are you beating him?
Maybe he could tell us who the fuck set us up.
If you fucking beat this prick long enough, he'll tell you started the goddamn Chicago fire. Now that don't necessarily make it fucking so!
Come on, man, think!
Kirk Baltz.
I think the first time I saw it was at AFI. There was a screening of it there, and they screened it for all the students up at AFI. Monty Hellman is very involved with AFI, and I think he had to do with that. And it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing. I, even watching it today, the way it's shot, the way it's lit, that warehouse space was lit in a way like it was a theater. And you could move anywhere inside of that space and you were lit. There's a moment in it where we're all, I think it's Nice Guy Eddie and Mr. White and Mr. Pink and Mr. Orange is over there and I'm in the chair and Michael Madsen is up on the hearse sitting up on top of that. And Harvey's talking to Chris and all of a sudden the door at the other end of the loft flops open. And Harvey was able to walk, it must be 15 yards at least, a good 30 feet, to the other side of the space, shut the door, and come back into the scene and keep the scene going. And so there were continually moments like that where everyone's work was so good, and it really was like we were all on a stage together. The whole thing was lit in a way and done in a way that we were that free to work with what was going on, you know, and the moment-to-moment givens in each scene and things that just popped up.
They did. If they hadn't done what I told them not to do, they'd still be alive.
My fucking hero.
Michael Madsen.
It's all designed for my own personal comfort. That wasn't a prop. I mean, that was in there. That was a real hearse that was in the warehouse. And I guess at some point in time, I decided to jump up on the back of the damn thing and sit down. Because I'm a very lazy actor. And in my own laziness, and, you know, I decided that maybe I needed to... Can I play this scene sitting down? Is there any way I can be sitting for this particular scene? How about if I go sit on the back of that car over there?
Now here's the news!
Monty Hellman.
You know, I didn't second guess Quentin, but one of the things I told him, and I said, if you want me to help you, I'll tell you one thing. I'm gonna stand up for you, I'm gonna take care of you, and I'm not gonna get in your way. I'm not gonna tell you how to direct the movie. And I never did. And I think that that's the way I would like to be treated by my producers. And I'm sure that Quentin was appreciative of that. And unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, really good filmmakers will wind up with material that isn't really ready. And it's too bad because, you know, the best filmmaker in the world can't make a really good movie out of a script that just isn't there. I mean, the main thing for me was that it was really funny. I'm attracted to comedy. I think all my movies are comedies, but some people might disagree. I have to say, I think he was right to direct it himself because I would have made it into something different. I usually take a script and I start all over again and frequently even rewrite a script. I wouldn't have rewritten it, but I would have directed it in a completely different way. And I think what he did was right for his script. Here's a case where, you know, the writer should either do his own stuff or he should get out of the way and let the director make his movie. It's two different movies.
Shit, you can torture me all you want.
Torture you.
Sally Menke.
My best friend at the time, I showed it to him a couple of times, and he basically watched the film under his coat. He was pretty... He didn't like the whole thing. In that scene, I just thought what Michael was doing was so cool. And for me, the ear cutting off scene when I was cutting it was not bad because, you know, I saw, you know, before they rolled or they're taping the ear on. And, you know, so it wasn't real. It wasn't, the emotion, the final emotion wasn't horrific to me. It was like, oh my God, look at what Michael Madsen is doing. My God, this is unbelievable, you know? Because he was so cool. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So that was a very different experience for me because it was not grotesque because, you know, I always saw them fixing the fake ear. It really took me away from it.
It's amusing to me to torture a cop. You can say anything you want because I've heard it all before.
The thing about the ear scene is that it's so shocking, but the way that Michael plays it and the way that it's written, it's just, the way he makes fun of the fact that the guy maybe can't hear with his ear off and things like that. It's, you know, I just find it really, really funny. And I think Michael is, I think the unfortunate thing for Michael is he's so brilliant in that and so perfect for it that he may never find another role that's as right for him, that he's as good in as in that. It's just, you know, one of those things.
You ever listen to Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s?
One of the things, the reason why the torture scene works so well is, like, you know, I kind of defy anybody to watch Michael Madsen do that dance and not kind of enjoy it. All right, it's kind of fun, and it was so great, whether in other countries, people talking in different languages, whenever they would describe, when Mr. Blonde does his dance, whenever they would say it, they would always do it. They'd always imitate it. They didn't even know they were doing it. They didn't even know their body was doing that. But so you see, when Mr. Blonde does his kind of little dance, they always had to kind of do it as they said those words. You know, in Japanese, all right, in French, Mr. Blonde, when he does the dance, and like, I defy anyone to not kind of enjoy it a little bit. And then, it cuts the guy's face in the air. But you know what? Fuck you. You were enjoying it. Up until that moment, you were enjoying it. So thus, you're certainly, you know, you're a co-conspirator, somewhat. You're culpable, all right, for what's happening. And then it gets worse, and then it gets worse, and it gets worse still, and then the ear-cutting scene happens, all right? And that's really bad. And then, when he talks in the ear, and goes, hey, can you hear me? Kind of throws it away, then the audience laughs again.
If it becomes too graphic, then it becomes silly, and the audience will find some way not to believe in it. I mean, the classic example is Les Enfants de Paradis, where the killing happens off camera, and you see it from the point of view of one of the thugs who's watching it happen, and just the look on his face conveys more horror than you could possibly have that if you'd seen the throat being slit or whatever was the action that was taking place. And I think that that's frequently the case where, you know, less is more.
Don't go anywhere, I'll be right back.
That actually is my favorite things I've ever done in a film, and I think one of my favorite things I'll ever do in a film is just that shot of you know, with the music playing and him walking outside and the music goes away and then you just hear like trees and you hear the way in the background, like, you know, some father teaching his kid how to, you know, play catch as far as baseball is concerned and everything, you know, on the front lawn, maybe a block away, and tweet tweet and all that kind of stuff, and then like in the same shot he picks up the can and goes back, and then, you know, boom, the song is playing again, he goes right into the dancing. That, you know, to me that was like that's pure cinema. I was really proud of it.
Quentin and I thought about that for a really long time and decided that that would be the kind of appropriate normalcy to have outside somewhere in the distance on an afternoon. You know, that would be just so different than what's happening in the warehouse. And then he goes back in and the music picks up again and we're back into that world. So it was just a moment where we left our reality, entered into our reality, and then went back into this film reality, you know, the character's reality.
Wow. All the table readings that we did were just us going through our lines and talking about situations and talking about some backstory and, you know, what was supporting what we were doing, what was holding everything up. Getting back to what was it like seeing it the first time at AFI, Harvey, he got up on the stage and talked a little bit after the film, and he was telling all these young, aspiring writers and directors and producers that it's really important to study acting. It's how important, and Quentin comes from that. He knew how to work with actors And Harvey was really trying to impress upon all these people at that night that it was so important to study acting. And you could see it in the audience. You could see the people that were like, you're right, and then you could see the ones that were like this. They don't get it. And I experienced that all the time on the film set. You know, like that, if you're working with someone that knows how to talk to you as an actor, that knows your language, that knows how to work with you that way, or doesn't, and is just completely result conscious from the gate. You know, they want what they want, and they don't really know how to convey that to you, so they're just gonna keep telling you the end result that they want, and that's incredibly frustrating. Quentin was never about that. He's always about, this is where I'd like to go to, let's begin to work on how we can get there.
Oh, big contribution go to prop department who arranged the blood. It was, we did kind of testing with blood this way, that way. And they did good job. Actually, you know, it was a lot of blood. It was kind of funny story because as film progress, he has his place. And every half an hour, 1 hour, they editing a little bit blood to feel fresh. And of course, the old blood get dry. So at one of the day, he was lying in the blood so long that the blood dry and he virtually stick to ground. It took probably 15 minutes to unglue Tim Roth out of blood. And it was sort of funny. He was laughing, everybody were joking, because we were really pulling him from the floor. And you know, all these hairs, it was really painful for him. But he has good time.
Yeah, I know.
Once again, it's film stock and the level of light. You see straight away it popping up the color. And you had to put a lot of light, and we take maximum out of lenses because we're correcting. If you have T-stop like around 4.5, it is maximum of performance of the lenses. So everything become sharp. Also hyper, very real.
I do. Mark. Freddy. 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 How do I look?
Now, Tim Roth, actually, I think kind of has like the most interesting story of how I got in the film, because I'd heard he was interested in it. And everybody else, none of the actors coming in, except for like unknowns and everything, were like jumping at Mr. Orange. All right, they all wanted to be Mr. Blonde and Mr. Pink. And it was kind of interesting, as I said, no one was pre-cast except for Harvey, but he's a really good linchpin in which to build the cast around. All right. And so Tim came in, and I totally knew who Tim Roth was. It was like, you know, Tim was like a budding art house superstar at the time that he became. That's exactly what he became, all right? Pretty much because of Reservoir Dogs, all right? But he was kind of on his way there. And so I watched a Made in Britain, first thing he did, and I watched Vincent Theo. And I always loved The Hit. I thought The Hit was like one of the best British crime thrillers to come out in a long, long time. And there is an aspect, especially since, you know, again, when I was saying all that stuff about Yakuza films and triad films, you definitely have to put like the British crime films of the 70s, like Villain, Joe Macbeth, that's in the 50s though, Get Carter, films like that, like in Sitting Target, which is a terrific British crime thriller with Oliver Reed. Reservoir Dogs is definitely in that lineage. Again, that's one of the reasons why, like, the Yobs, all right, young working class lads in England, like, responded to it so much. So what happened was, I was really into Tim. I just wanted to give him the part. And I call Harvey up and go, look, I know we had this thing that I wouldn't give him the part, you know, unless he read. And he's not going to read, but this is the guy, man. This is the guy. Well, Quentin, I'm very glad you're excited, but, you know, allow me to confirm your feelings. I'm happy that you're excited. I'm happy you've got that sound in your voice. Now let's confirm it. All right. So I think me and you and Tim, you know, we should, you know, have a little lunch and then, you know, talk him into reading. All right. So we get together at a delicatessen, and we have the big long talk, but Tim ain't reading. So eventually, like, you know, Harvey's like, well, okay, and he leaves. And me and Tim keep on. Now it's like 8 o'clock at night. All right. And it's like, okay, you want to go somewhere? Yeah, let's go to a bar. And we're sitting at the Coach and Horses, and we're getting drunker and drunker, and again, talking about movies and life and what it is we want. And we're young, passionate men just on the cusp of our dreams. All right. And you have all the passion and all the opinions and everything, all right? And this guy's just fucking cool, all right? And I think he's thinking the same thing about me, and so we're just knocking back the beers, man, all right? And just getting drunk like the way you can really only get with a British guy, you know, sitting in a pub. And so we're getting smashed. Now it's about, like, 20 minutes to 2, and we're totally shit-faced. And Tim goes, you know what? I'll read for you now. You want to read? I'll read. I'll read your fucking script. Here we go. I go, well, I don't have the script now, but I remember the scene. Let me get some piece of paper, and I'll write the dialogue out, and we'll read it. He goes, no, you don't have to do that. I got the script at home. It's me and you. I'm doing an Australian accent. Sorry about that. Let's get the fuck out of here, and we'll go to, we'll go to liquor store, pick up some beer. We go to the house, I'll read a fucking script. We go to a store, pick us more beer, then go to his place, and we read the whole script. All right, with him playing Mr. Orange, me playing every other character. It was the bonding experience there. And you know what? In a weird way, the same damn thing happened with Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction.
Use the commode story.
What's a commode story?
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell. Because if you ain't a great actor, you're a bad actor. And bad acting is bullshit in this job. Yeah.
Lawrence Bender.
When we were doing interviews before, people would ask, well, what's your favorite scene? And it'd always be different because there's so many good scenes in that movie. I love the scene when the cop is telling Tim Roth, you got to be specific. You know, when you go in that bathroom, you know, is it paper dispenser or is it a blower? You know, how many urinals were in there? You know, and this whole thing about being specific. And I'll never forget. I remember Quentin Harvey talking about this, and I think Harvey gave Quentin Hamlet. I think that's the way it went. And there's a great speech Hamlet has to the players where he says, "Speak the speech, I pray you, trippingly on the tongue. Do not saw the air with your hands thus," and I forget the speech now, honestly, but he's teaching the actors how to act, or in a sense, or, you know, saying he doesn't want it's overacting, and be specific. And Quentin kind of used that a little bit in the rehearsal process.
What you got to do is to take all them details, man, and make them your own. While you're doing that, you got to remember that this story is about you and how you perceive the events that went down. The only way to do that, my brother, keep saying it, saying it, and saying it, and saying it, and saying it.
With the first two films that I did, television films that I did, I felt like I'd had a real crash course in acting. And I didn't really want to be a theater actor, I wanted to be a film actor. But from very early on, although I was doing stage at the time, I was having success at it, I really wanted to do films.
They give me a call and they say, "Hey, Freddie." Say, "Hey, dude, you getting some? You can get some for me too." Like, they knew I still smoked, so they asked me to buy some for them when I was buying for me. But it got to be. Got to be. Every time I bought some weed, I was buying for 4 or 5 different fucking people. Finally, I said, "Fuck this shit. I'm making this bitch rich. She didn't have to do jack shit. She never even had to meet these people. I was doing all the work." But then that got to be a pain in the ass. People call me.
I like, you just show up, you've learnt your lines, hit your marks, and if you've got any good ideas, throw them in there. If they don't like them, don't do them. You know? Actually, I don't know if it's beneficial, really, for an actor to really know what's going on in a director's mind. That's not necessary. I mean, I really don't know what he was thinking. But it takes you a long time as an actor. A lot of actors never really like to think of it. But it's a director's medium film. It's not an actor's medium. I like it. I like being in the director's hands. So you can have. That's why I quite often now don't watch films that I'm in. Very rarely now. I just concentrate on the experience of making the film and then move on.
Take a little bit, sell it to my close friends. She agreed to that, said, we keep the same arrangement as before, 10% free pot for me, as long as I helped her out that weekend. She had a brick of weed she was selling. She didn't want to go to the buy alone. The brother usually goes with her, but he's in county unexpectedly.
What for?
His traffic ticket's gone warm. They stopped him for something, found warrant something.
As far as I'm concerned, I can't think of any times when I needed to improvise. It was kind of irrelevant because it's written in such a fluid way, in such a naturalistic way. Well, it's not actually, it's quite heightened, but it feels, it comes out of your mouth in a very natural way. So it wasn't necessary to improvise. I remember there was one time where I had a monologue which was supposed to be a voiceover. We were in a hotel bathroom. See in the toilet where two cops come in, it's part of my yarn to gain their trust, gain the villain's trust. And he had a 360 track going around me, and he said, well, just, you know, we sent the sound guys home. He said, well, it's just time out for the camera move. Why don't you say it, and then just so we know what speed we're supposed to go. And I started to say it, and he did the track was going around, and we both looked at each other and went, this is good. So we had to page the sound guys to get them back, and we shot that with me doing the speech in the toilet with the cops coming in and stuff. And that's the kind of, that's not improvisation on my behalf, that's improvisation on his behalf as a filmmaker. Very clever.
There's blood in my veins, everything I have is screaming, take off, man. Just bail, just get the fuck out of there. Panic hits me like a bucket of water. First there's a shock of it, bam, right in the face. And I'm just standing there drenched in panic, and all these sheriffs looking at me, and they know, man, they can smell it. Sure as that fucking dog can, they can smell it on me.
Shut up.
Hey, so anyway.
Him in the bathroom was always scripted, but him talking in the bathroom was not scripted. And it was one of those things where they were on the set, I wasn't there, and because they had shot it two different ways or three different ways in there, and I believe it was Quentin who said, you know, this would be an, or maybe it was a group effort where they said, why don't you say this dialogue here? I think it would be really great. And when we got into the cutting room, in fact, it just was fantastic to have Tim continuing his dialogue in the bathroom when it kind of just takes it to a, you know, a whole nother kind of level to have him saying the dialogue that was supposed to be just voiceover over him in the bathroom, and then to have him say it there. It's just like another step into, you know, time reality breaks, and worked out spectacular. I loved it.
Oh, these are other things which we shot, like 100 frames per second, all this.
Police brutality.
You know how to handle that situation. Just shit in your pants and dive in and swim.
Oh, but the moment when he lit the cigarette is just step printing. So it was one of the most advanced special effects in this movie. They did in post-production. If you take it back, you will see what I'm talking about.
Invisible bitch and flame on and shit.
Thing. Motherfucker looks just like the thing.
Yeah.
Hey, showtime. Grab your jacket. Parked outside.
I'll be right down.
It'd be right down.
Richard Gladstein.
Well, never expected the film to catch on as well as it did, because it was such a small film. So you never expect something to sort of burst out that way. It's an incredibly rewarding feeling that you imagined something and it came to be this thing, and then other people like it. It's just incredibly gratifying thing. So the fact that anyone goes to see a movie that you made is a shocking thing. And to have something really catch on and people mimic it, and you hear kids talking like that, or you hear, you see a skit on Saturday Night Live that imitates your film. It's shocking that a little movie can enter culture and become part of the culture of your world. It's just a shocking thing. And I think Quentin is, he's such a sort of provocative thinker and a provocative filmmaker that by accident, it's not on purpose that he sets out to create something that gets imitated. His agenda is not to become popular. His agenda is to tell a story that feels to him absolutely natural. And the fact that it then catches on is this other life entirely. But when he writes it and shoots it, it's so for himself. It's completely for himself. There is an audience of one. When he watches the movie, and it becomes that much more rewarding, I think, to him and to me, to anyone involved. He's just doing it because he has to do it and he likes it. I think he's thinking about the story he created, and that Mr. White says this to Mr. Pink, and what would Mr. Pink do now? Would he run out with the bag, or would he stay in there? And what does he do when you tell him this? And in his head, I don't think that there's a chance he's thinking, oh, well, the audience is going to laugh here, so I better pause. I don't think he thinks that way for a second. I think he just tells a story that feels natural to him, and that's probably why other people like it.
There's a slight difference.
Very funny. You know what I mean. What a white bitch will put up with, a black bitch wouldn't put up with for a minute, man. They got a line, and if you cross it, they fuck you up.
I gotta go along with Pink on that one. I've seen it happen.
Okay, Mr. Expert, if this is such a truism, why is it that every nigger I know treats his woman like a piece of shit?
I'll make you a bet that those same damn niggers who are showing their ass in public, when their bitches get them home, man, they chill the fuck out.
Not these guys.
Oh, yeah, those guys too.
Reservoir Dogs came out live, which is Artisan Now, all right, and really, Live had been around before, and they were like the home video company of Caralco, all right, and they basically came out with all the straight-to-video movies and stuff. That was like their little thing, but like, anyway, if ever they made one good enough to release at the theaters, then they could, and they would. Well, they weren't a real serious company except for that year. That year, about four films at Sundance were financed either by Ronald Wallace and Richard Gladstein at Live, either completely or in part. Reservoir Dogs was one. Bad Lieutenant, which wasn't at Sundance, but was like all the other festivals right afterwards. Light Sleeper, which had its little world premiere. And Bob Roberts. All right. So really, Live kicked themselves into the independent filmmaking thing like in a big way in that year. You really realize when I made my deal with them, I made my deal with a home video company that had no track record whatsoever as far as theatrical release was concerned. So I wasn't even guaranteed a theatrical release. All right, it just had to be good. All right, maybe we could get one. Because they're this video company, they made like, you know, they made this like killer deal on Miramax. So Miramax only got the theatrical rights. All right, so they didn't get the video and they didn't get foreign. So after the theatrical does what it's going to do, and then they have this big winner with Crying Game, they could have like done the whole Oscar push and everything, but they get nothing for it. We had already played theatrical, all right? Every dime they would have put into selling the movie as far as Oscar stuff, and that is a putting, that's like a second release. That can be even more expensive than the first release, especially the way they released it. All right, you know, they would not see any profit for that. That would all go to Live. Now, I understood that. Well, why the fuck should they? What did they get out of it? All right, there's like no incentive. They made, you guys made such a killer deal that you were so proud of that you cut off any incentive to do a second thing with it. So I kind of understood that.
How would you feel if every time you had to take a piss, you had to do a fucking handstand?
Oh, you guys like to tell jokes and giggle and kid around, huh? Giggling like a bunch of young bros in a schoolyard. Well, let me tell a joke. Five guys sitting at a bullpen, San Quentin, wondering how the fuck they got there. What did we do wrong? What should have we done? What didn't we do? Whatever that. It's your fault, my fault, his fault. All that bullshit.
Finally, Monty Hellman.
The interesting thing is the things that were funniest in reading it the first time weren't necessarily the scenes that were funniest when I saw the movie or when I saw what he did with certain scenes. I mean, I thought that, you know, the obvious scenes are that first scene and the scene where they assign the colors. I mean, those scenes are really funny on the page, and they're funny in the movie. But funnier for me are the scenes where they cut off the ear, for instance. I mean, I know that sounds like, what kind of a horrible person am I? But that's a funny scene. And, I mean, it's black comedy, but it's funny. And the scene, you know, I think Quentin gets a lot of his material from watching stand-up comics. And that's what's so funny about the script. There's that kind of stand-up comedy, comic quality to some of those scenes.
Where a bank maybe arrived in, say, Petersburg. All I want you guys to talk about, if you have to, is what you're gonna do. That should do it. Here are your names. Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange.
A case can be made that Reservoir Dogs started independent cinema and going in a different direction, away from just either the Sundance, How Do We Save the Farm, you know, regional movie, or the Sundance gay film, all right? It put independent cinema, it, you know, mixed genre into independent cinema, and then, like, kind of, and started kind of a new road there, because independent cinema had been really trading heavily in sex, with no problem whatsoever, all right? But violence, all right, was just considered, you know, oh, the violence won't work. The violence won't work with, not with our crowd, not with our cafe latte crowd. That's not going to work. All right? And then when Reservoir Dogs didn't do that breakout, you know, guys like Ira Deutschman and everything, and finally, see, I told you, it's because of the violence, you know? Gus Van Sant's gay sex, that's all good. All right, you know, Swoon, that's all good. All right, you know, but, you know, the violence, not for our crowd. And now it's really hard for, like, an independent film, except for that one or two a year, to actually crack almost, like, $2 million now. Boy, if your movie stays for more than a week at the Sunset Five now, as far as independent cinema is concerned, then, like, hey, you've done good. You're eating each other. But everyone was expecting Reservoir Dogs to be this big breakout, not to do well for an independent film, but just to do great. All right? They were expecting it to break records. Now, it keeps getting quoted that it made like $2 million domestically, but it actually made $3 million. I was counting fucking Variety every week, all right?
It's parked across the street. It's like in the signal, then he pulls up in front of the store.
Mr. Blonde and Mr. Blue.
Crowd control, they handle the customers and employees.
That girl's ass.
It's sitting right here on my dick.
Myself and Mr. Pink?
You two take the manager in the back and make him give you the diamonds. We're there for those stones, period. Since no display cases are being fucked with, no alarms should go off.
Lawrence Bender.
Yeah, I mean, Reservoir Dogs, I mean, you know, they pre-sold it all over the world. In England, I think it grossed, I can't remember, is it 15 million pounds, I think it was? Maybe 10 million pounds. I don't remember. I think it grossed about $20 million anyway around the world. You know, although it only did $3 million here, the video sales were huge, and became kind of a big cult following. So by the time we made Pulp Fiction, it seemed like everybody had seen Reservoir Dogs. I'll never forget. we were up at Harvey Keitel's house, and we were casting Pulp Fiction, and Bruce Willis was there. And so Bruce and Quentin started talking. They took a walk on the beach. But Bruce and all his buddies, they had, like, learned. They had seen Reservoir Dogs, like, five times, and they were saying all the lines, and it was just one of these great things where, yeah, wow, this is Bruce Willis, wow, and, you know, he knew all the lines to our movie, and I remember I was making another movie later on called Fresh, we were shooting in New York City, and my sister was going to NYU, and I went up to her dormitory, and it was like a shrine where just all these pictures and stuff for Reservoir Dogs, and all these, you know, young guys had a Reservoir Dogs bulletin board up there. And I went up and saw, like, holy cow, this is my movie, you know? So it's, it affected all kinds of different people. It just got this great following in different parts of the world.
It probably went on for about a year or two, but like for at least the first few months of its release, no English comedian could go up and do a stand-up act without like working some Reservoir Dogs joke into it. There was Reservoir Dogs political jokes in the newspapers all the time. All right, just, you know, putting Brezhnev or, you know, Margaret Thatcher or, you know, in a black suit and having him shoot people or something. It was so bizarre. To land in England, man, it was like, oh, I thought I was doing great being the art house darling in America. This is what it's like when your movie is number one in a country. But now, not only that, there was another aspect that really rang a bell big time in England. And that was just kind of the Cinderella aspect of me having worked in a video store and didn't have any family connections, no money, worked in a video store, and by sheer want to, was able to make a film. All right, you know, the class system still does exist in England. And it, you know, it just kind of like, you know, kind of highlighted the American dream in this big, big, giant way that actually had resonance for a lot of young, disenfranchised youth in England. I remember, like, you know, going to the Virgin Megastore, and video store, and everything. And they all knew what I looked like, all right. And then I walked into a, you know, video store. And go, "Yo, Quentin Tarantino, right? You're quite a hero around here, mate." All right, and so it was like, you know, all of a sudden people were like joining video stores and like, hey, this is like a legitimate way. I mean, in England, I mean, even more than here, it's like, no, if you're gonna do that, you gotta go to school. Forget about the fact we don't have a film industry for you to work in when you're done, all right? But if you're even gonna think about it, you gotta go to school. You quit school and you joined a video store and you did it? All right, so there was this real claim in it, you know, aspect that really kind of fueled it even more so. So that was like a, you know, so that was a pretty cool thing.
Festivals are, first of all, they're fantastic, and especially when you're just starting out, because, and especially when you've been broke and you haven't been able to go anywhere, because it's a way to see the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, someone in Spain calls you up and say, "Hey, we want to see your movie. Will you guys come?" And you're like, "Spain, sure," you know, or "Italy, sure," or, you know, "Japan," or what, you know, these are places I've never gotten to go before. So just in terms of opening your eyes up to the world, it was fantastic. And it's great, you get to, as a young filmmaker, you get to meet other filmmakers. All of a sudden, you know, you, as someone just struggling, you don't necessarily always get to meet other filmmakers. And all of a sudden, you're meeting all your peers, and you're seeing all these other movies that you don't normally get to see because they don't all get distributed. And so it's great from that perspective. And also, because we went around the world with Reservoir Dogs, we got to meet a lot of the financiers from other countries. Financiers and distributors from France and from Spain and from just Europe and Asia. So as a producer, it's great because as you move on and you start, you know, raising money, you've met a lot of different people in different parts of the world who finance movies. And as a director, it's great because you've done your publicity in different countries and you start to be known. So as you progress in your career, foreign sales are, you know, are worth more than domestic sales. So it, from a career point of view, it's important.
I don't buy it.
It never got released in Korea because of the torture scene to the cop. You can't do, it's like sort of disrespectful to do things to law enforcement officers. All right, in Korea. I was like saying, oh, so you mean if that wasn't a cop, you could do, oh, yeah, yeah. You can't do that to a cop in Korea. But the thing that was interesting that happened is I've never been anywhere before. All right, so the actual idea of going to all these different countries, you know, I went from like having never gone anywhere to like, in 1 year, being on three different continents. I remember Alex Rockwell at the Sundance Film Festival said, "Quentin, this movie's gonna be your passport to the world." Now, he didn't mean in terms of like, you know, fame. He just meant like, you're gonna be able to go places. You're gonna be able to start living your life now, and this movie is your ticket. Yeah, you know, I felt like I was a rock star on tour, all right? And you kind of are. And you go that year-long festival circuit. And met, you know, friends like Alex and Robert Rodriguez that are like some of my best friends to this very, very, very day. And, you know, I always love the idea, concept of a, you know, fellowship of filmmakers. Anyway. And so what happened was, it is because of Reservoir Dogs and the fact that it did so well overseas, it did about, like, all in all, about $20 million foreign. It made about, like, you know, $1 million to $900 or $800. All right, in every country it was released that I went to. And that was where I became an international filmmaker, all right? Because it's like, you know, you could actually see the grosses if I didn't go to the country and if I did go to the country. And yeah, you could just look at it right there. Okay, this didn't do so well there, this did well there because I went. And you go, and one of the things about it was, even if the film like did okay, when I left, I was famous. It was strange the way that worked. It's like, you know, you go to Brazil and you do the Brazilian version of the Jay Leno show, and you know, you do interviews in all the Brazilian newspapers, all right, and you're on the Brazilian Howard Stern show, and then you're on the, you know, Brazilian version of this and the Brazilian version of that, and then you leave. And so when you go, Brazil knows who the hell I am. So when they go back to sell the next Quentin Tarantino movie, all right, then I don't mean to talk about myself in the third person, but the thing is, when they go to sell that next movie with my name, and like, they know who I am, Brazil. Like, oh yeah, we like him here. He's popular. He's very famous. All right. And that has been, they're all Reservoir Dogs' father. And literally, you know, the Asian audience there really sees it differently as the American audience. And give you one example. I don't want to super explain. I don't like to explain subtextual things in the movie, because anything you've thought and saw and have come up with yourself, I want you to just keep it. I mean, you know what I mean? You know, because my feeling is, you know, I do what I do, and I know what I felt about it and everything. But then it's all for you now, all right? I like the idea, almost the opposite of like an Oliver Stone concept, is like where he has like one idea that, you know, if a million people see his movie, he wants a million people to come out with that idea, all right? If a million people see my movie, I want everyone to have made a million different, slightly different movies in their head.
I respect my dad and I respect you, but I will put fucking bullets right through your heart.
Quentin's gonna get mad at me for saying this, is he? We literally were out of time. What had to happen is, Keitel was gonna shoot Lawrence. I was gonna shoot Keitel. Before Keitel dies, he swings around and shoots me. And what happened was, my squib went off before Harvey could get, it was a mistake. We didn't have enough time for another take. And we could not do another take. Quentin said, don't worry about it. They'll be asking this forever. And he's right. And that's what happened. Then I found out he was selling t-shirts that says, who shot Nice Guy Eddie? I said, where's my cut? He said, it was my idea. So I moved on, not you.
I've always thought that Mr. Pink did get away, which is like one of the reasons in the beginning that I wanted to play Mr. Pink. Because I thought that not only would I survive, but I had more dialogue, more scenes with Mr. Keitel. And then I would also survive. For the sequel, and I wouldn't have to talk anyone into believing that I was in the emergency room. But I know you hear a lot of gunshots, and you assume that he's been done in. But I think that'd be a better question for Steve, if you can ever get him to agree to an interview. But I think maybe he got away. You know, I'd like to think that one of them did.
From time to time, people have asked, or even writers have written, well, it's rather odd, it's rather inconceivable, it's rather, you know, unbelievable, all right, that Mr. Orange would admit that he's a cop to Mr. White, you know, right at that given moment, where all he has to pretty much do is just shut his mouth for the next minute, for the next 60 seconds, and he's okay, all right, the cops will come in and save him. Now, if you've ever felt that, you might like Reservoir Dogs, but you didn't get it. And it's just that simple. Anyone who said, oh, I really liked the movie, but why did Mr. Orange tell Mr. White he's a cop? You know, I'm not trying to be a smartass, but it is that, and the answer is that, well, if you don't know, I can't tell you. And, but oddly enough, in Hong Kong, in Japan, you show Reservoir Dogs, nobody would ask that question. They get it. And as a matter of fact, in Japan, they have a word, like, to describe it. Not only is there not an English language equivalent of the word, there's no adjectives in the English language that can really do the word justice as far as describing it. The word is called jingi. It's like J-I-N-G-I, jingi. The closest thing to jingi as far as like trying to describe it in America, is honor and humanity. But that's a weak description of Jingyi. Jingyi is beyond honor. Jingyi isn't beyond humanity, but it's beyond honor with a little bit of humanity in there. The best way to describe Jingyi, and it's also often used in like Yakuza movies, it's the thing you must do, even if you don't want to. When Mr. Orange tells Mr. White he's a cop, in that 160 seconds that Mr. White can do something about it, that's Jingyi. So, there is a different take from all these different countries and all these different audiences on the very same movie, which is really kind of cool.
This track was produced by Three Legged Cat Productions for Artisan Home Entertainment. The editors, Cyril Pluvier, Francois Morin. The interview is produced by Jennifer Peterson and Mark Rantz. Now let me get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up, said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, doctor. Put the lime in the coconut.